Finally today, in some European cities, soldiers have appeared on the streets to enforce the strict lockdown measures against COVID-19. National governments are focused almost single-handedly on fighting the virus and propping up their economies. But leaders speak of coronavirus as a war. And under the fog of war, other crises erupt. And that includes sectarian and religious tensions that could now go unchecked. Dr. Eleanor Gordon of the Gender, Peace and Security Centre at Monash University has been writing about this issue.
The world's attention is currently on crises at home, so we're very much focused on the threat that we're facing from COVID-19 here in Australia and elsewhere. But actually, it's going to be the conflict-affected environments, the war zones, that are going to be very badly hit. And that's for a number of reasons. They have damaged health systems, or they're completely destroyed. There is a lack of medical equipment, ventilators, personal protective equipment. The people are very vulnerable. They already have, many of them, weak immune systems because of years of limited access to food and healthcare, lack of access to clean water or malnutrition, and they are unable to socially distance themselves from each other, particularly if they're in displacement camps or refugee camps, such as in Somalia or Nigeria or Cox's Bazar Moira camp in Greece and so on. On top of that, there's a lack of trust in authorities and health systems. So they're unlikely to respond favourably to any health information that they get about how to protect themselves.
I know there's another issue too that you've written about, and it's interesting to reflect on this because 75 years ago at this time, the world, World War II was ending. And if I recall my history correctly, the worst parts of the Nazi violence occurred as they became more desperate in their impending defeat. And there was the so-called, you know, violence under the fog of war. Coronavirus is not a war, but the war analogy is invoked often. Where do you think coronavirus could be used as a sort of cover for increasing violence?
We're currently seeing, whilst there's been a positive response to the UN Secretary General's call for a global ceasefire, what we're actually seeing is some states are taking advantage of the crisis to repress or persecute people. For example, lockdowns in Yemen are preventing people from accessing food. There are also a number of armed actors which seem to take advantage of the crisis, perhaps thinking that the world's attention is elsewhere or there's not the ability to respond as swiftly as there was previously. So, for example, we've seen a number of attacks by ISIS in Iraq, and there have been a resumption of sectarian attacks in Afghanistan. And also, a number of states and groups might take advantage of instability to make political and economic gains. And we saw that this happened during the Ebola outbreak, causing instability in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. So there is real cause for concern. Even many of the countries where there have been positive responses to the UN Secretary General's call for ceasefires, and where parties to the conflict have declared a ceasefire, there have been often caveats or conditions to those ceasefires and even outbreaks of hostilities in many of those countries where ceasefires have been declared.
Yeah, I was going to raise that with you because we did read that, I think, in the Philippines, where there's a sectarian low-level war that's been going on for years, but also in parts of Yemen, I did read where they had put down their weapons or at least stopped firing. But you say, what, that's all very fragile?
It is very fragile. There are two things that could happen to make those declarations less fragile. If there was a UN Security Council resolution endorsing the UN Secretary General's call for global ceasefires, which we're anticipating any day now, but it really needs to happen quickly, there also needs to be monitoring of ceasefires so that if there are any hostilities that are breaking out, the world's attention is drawn to them. So the parties to the conflict are held accountable. So you raise the example of Philippines. The New People's Army, for example, has recently extended its ceasefire, but the government has not extended its ceasefire. So it elapsed on the 15th of April. Part of the reason is because there's a lack of trust between the parties. So if these clashes were monitored and the ceasefire was monitored more effectively, then they're likely to hold.
There is, Eleanor, though, a precedent for at least some sort of durable ceasefire during a crisis. What happened in Aceh back in 2004 when the tsunami hit Indonesia?
Well, that led to a sustainable peace. So I think what we're seeing now and what we're concerned about is that these declarations of ceasefires are going to be short-lived because the dynamics of the conflict and the causes of the conflict are not being addressed. But in 2004, after the tsunami, there was a lasting peace in Aceh. And partly that's because there was a recognition that there's a bigger threat being faced. But partly, in fact, probably more so, it was because the world's attention was now on the area. So the Indonesian government was more likely to respond favorably to calls for ceasefire. And also the Free Aceh movement recognized that it could be seen as a legitimate party taken seriously by the international community. So it was the fact that the international community was focusing much more attention on this conflict that led to a sustainable peace there.
You mentioned earlier that the self-styled Islamic State group had been trying to resuscitate its war in, I'm assuming, Iraq and Syria. How has it specifically taken advantage of the coronavirus crisis?
I think it's certainly recognizing that there's less ability and inclination on the part of state actors to respond to any movements it may take. So there was a recent publication and it was calling its members to take advantage of the instability and crisis at the moment. So of course you see in Iraq that the government is very much focused on responding to the threat posed by COVID-19 and taking all necessary measures to ensure that any outbreak is contained. And so that there is an opportunity here for ISIS and also other non-state armed groups to utilize that opportunity to perhaps gain ground.
We haven't in Western democracies quite yet seen armed tanks rolling down boulevards in the cities to regulate people's behaviour. But we have seen the armies deployed to assist the fight against coronavirus in lots of Western countries. What are the implications of that for international hotspots where there are conflict?
The concern is that if there are resumptions in conflict or if conflict is sustained or it escalates, few UN member states, for example, are going to be willing to deploy troops to help keep the peace. So there is a concern there, and it's not just peacekeeping forces, but it's also broader development actors, peacebuilding actors. Many of them can't travel. Many of them have been repatriated or are trying to work remotely. And of course, you can't assist people in need in conflict-affected environments if you're coordinating from a hotel room or from outside the country. So there's real concern there that there aren't simply the resources to be able to respond to COVID-19 or the conflict or other humanitarian crises.
Dr. Eleanor Gordon of the Gender, Peace and Security Centre at Monash University, and there are links to her articles at the Religion and Ethics Report homepage. And that's it for this week. You can catch us anytime on the podcast or at iTunes. Thanks to Mudita Dias and Simon Branthwaite. I'm Andrew West. I'm back next week.